Tonight's Job chapter 27. Job chapter 27. And Job again took up his discourse and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood, and my tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days." Back in the 21st chapter, Job had accused his friends of answering nothing but falsehood, and he reiterates that here. He begins by saying, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter," and then he goes on to state that he will never give in to the counselor's evaluation of him. In other words, they have said that he is a sinner who has sinned and brought this affliction on himself. And he has denied that, and now he says something of very great strength and import. He actually makes an oath. He swears. He says, "As God lives." Now, this can remind us of the kind of oaths that we take in court to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help you God. It can remind us of people who take oaths by saying, "As God is my witness." But this is a little bit more than either one of those oaths, because this says, "As God lives." As God lives. And when you put it that way, you add a very important element to your oath. If God lives, then God's going to see whether the statement you're making is true or not. God is going to be the judge. God is going to dispense justice and punish all liars. So what Job is doing here at this point is handing his case over to God and saying, "As God lives." And the commentators say that this kind of terminology was used as a last resort by defendants in cases. They would simply rest their testimony on the fact that God lives and would judge whether or not they're telling the truth. This is kind of similar, isn't it, to the last resort of Paul as he appears before Festus. You remember that Festus wanted to do the Jews a favor, and he said, "How would you like to go back to Jerusalem and be tried there?" And Paul said, "I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I've done no wrong, as you yourselves know very well. If then I'm a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." So that was a similar sort of moment as Job says, "I appeal to the God who lives, the God who will judge, the God who will vindicate me." Now, the Lord, of course, as you know from the rest of the book, is going to declare that God is in the right. But what Job is doing here is very interesting in two ways, because first of all, again, he's not claiming sinless perfection. He never has. But he does say in verse 6, I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. The Hebrew word for heart there is the word that is very much the equivalent in passages like this of our English word conscience. And the conscience is, of course, mentioned many times in the New Testament. It appears 30 times in the New Testament. Let's talk for a moment about the biblical doctrine of the conscience. The very word conscience comes from a Latin word, conscientia, which means to know together. And what that means is you know together with others. You and others share the same knowledge in your being. So you go into a given culture and you can usually find what the cultural belief is about something according to the conscience. And normally, there will be some vestige of conscience left so that you're able to find God's law written on the conscience. But sometimes that may be hard to find. Why would it be hard to find? Yes, Dave?
Well, first would be the death in Adam.
Yeah.
Next would be idolatry. And next would be God giving them up.
Yeah.
And then their conscience becomes seared.
Yeah, their understanding is darkened, first of all, anyway. And then, if God gives them up to a reprobate mind, their conscience, in fact, may be so seared. What a conscience is supposed to do, and I looked this up in the Evangelical Dictionary of Theology, and I found that it was so interesting. I wanted to share some of it with you. You're not doing anything else tonight, are you? Okay. Conscience, the duty of the function of conscience is threefold. First, it is obligatory. It urges man to do that which he regards as right and restrains him from doing that which he regards as wrong. But, of course, your conscience can be seared, and you can actually think that a right thing to do is something that, according to God's law, is wrong. The great missionary book, Peace Child, by Don Richardson, tells how Don Richardson went to Irianjaya as a missionary and told the story of Jesus, and all the natives cheered when he got to Judah's betrayal of Jesus. He thought, what in the world is happening here? They thought Judas was the hero, because their idea of a hero in that culture was someone who so took someone else into his confidence over a long period of time that he trusted him completely, and then he sprang the trap on him, and they cheered for Judas. So, conscience alone is not a safe guide, but in each individual culture, it performs the same thing. It urges man to do that which he regards as right and restrains him from doing that which he regards as wrong. That's the obligatory function. Then it's got a judicial function. It passes judgment upon man's decisions and acts. And you know that Paul makes that very point when he says about the Gentiles, they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse them or excuse them. It either accuses them or excuses them. And that's what conscience does. It acts in a judicial function. We think about ourselves, you did this, that was wrong, you did that, that was right, you did this, that wasn't so bad. Everybody else does it. The third function of a conscience is executive. Conscience executes its judgment in the heart of man. It condemns his action when in conflict with his conviction by causing an inward disquietude, distress, shame, or remorse. It commends when man has acted in conformity with his convictions. I did the right thing, I'm happy. I did the wrong thing, I'm ashamed. That's the executive function. And so this article has a lot of interesting statements. It speaks of an erring conscience. And that's a misnomer, because conscience doesn't err, but the standard or the basis of which the conscience acts might be in error. Yes, brother.
It's interesting that you describe how, in your opening statement about the conscience, the explanation for it you gave, that it's a knowledge among people. You turn straight to Romans 1:19, and you find in Greek that same word, because, and Paul says, because that which is known about God is evident among them,
mm-hmm.
for God made it evident to them. And then it goes down, you know, explaining this is what happens when you suppress the truth of God in your unrighteousness. The conscience is seared.
That's right. That's right. That's right, and it can, and again, it can vary from culture to culture or group to group. There's something called a morbid, perverted, or narrow conscience. This is a conscience out of proper balance, narrow, fanatic, bigoted. There is a pathological and neurotic conscience. This has its origin in a psychic disorder, or in a neurosis related to phobias, obsessions, fixed ideas, and compulsions. There's a doubting conscience. The Bible talks about that. It's a doubting conscience, and that is a conscience that acts in uncertainty. So you remember what it says there at the end of Romans 14 and 14:23, where it says, but whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith. For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. So there can be varieties of consciences among Christians. David Wilkerson, the great director of Teen Challenge and who wrote The Cross and the Switchblade, was horrified when he went to visit Christians in France and they kept pouring glasses of wine for him. They had a completely different conscience about that sort of thing than he did. Then there can be the seared conscience, and that's a dulled or calloused or dead conscience, and that's a condition wherein conscience ceases to function because of repeated disregard of its warning voice. Once saw a movie where one of the actors said, I can tell my conscience to go sit in a corner. Well, if you do that too often, then you won't hear the voice of that conscience at all. Just say one more thing. Conscience is a gift of God. It is a guardian of morality, justice, and decency in the world. It is an irrefutable testimony to the existence of God. And C.S. Lewis pointed out that everybody lives according to a code, and the question is, where did you get the code? Some of it's from the culture, but not all of it. Because, as he argues, every culture would agree that murder is wrong. At least, you know, some murders under some circumstances. Every country would agree that adultery is wrong. Every country agrees that theft is wrong. Every culture has these things in common. But it becomes harder and harder, as you know, to witness to someone whose conscience is seared. How was Paul the Pharisee's conscience awakened? By the law. The law said, thou shalt not covet. And then all of a sudden, it says that it killed him because he recognized that he coveted. And then all of a sudden, he goes even further and says that the law worked in him all kinds of covetousness. just because of the commandment. So an awakened conscience is one of the first things that has to happen when the gospel is proclaimed, and sometimes it's very difficult to achieve that because of the type of culture that you are trying to reach. My point about Job is this. In the days of Job, we don't read of there being yet the revealed Torah, the revealed law of God, in the form of the Mosaic law. Instead, apparently the standards under which these people were operating at the time, before the law, was the law written on their hearts, the work of the law written on their hearts, as Paul says in Romans 2. And they were going by their conscience. And Paul is saying in verse 6, I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. And you can imagine how shocking that statement would have been to his counselors, as so many of his statements were. But what is amazing about Job in saying this is, if you go back to verse 2 and you see the description of God there, it is God who, Job says, has taken away his right and made his soul bitter. And it is that God that he swears by. As the Lord lives, as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter. And when you think about that, that is pretty amazing faith, because usually the reaction of an unbeliever or a very weak believer is that when something really bad and tragic happens into their lives, what happens to their faith in God? Gone. Like, how could God have allowed this? They're not sure there even is a God anymore. And they begin to doubt the existence of God. But what was Job's reaction when, first of all, the crisis came to his animals and his family? He rose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And think again of what happened to his when his wife said to him, when he was scraping himself with the broken pottery while he was sitting in the ashes, and his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Isn't that amazing? Many pastors would, I guess, say when Job said, shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil, that Job was making a terrible mistake. He was making a great theological error there, because he was saying he had received that evil from God. And then in the next statement, it says, nope, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Well, see, what's amazing about Job's oath tonight is that he is swearing by not only the God who lives and will see whether or not he's telling the truth, he is swearing by the God who has taken away his right and the Almighty who has made his soul bitter. Now, brothers and sisters, that is great faith. That's great faith when you can say, it is the Lord who has done this. It is the Lord who can undo it. It is the Lord who has permitted it. There must be a purpose in it. It is the Lord to whom we must cling for ultimate justice beyond the injustice that he has allowed. That's faith. Because you're saying, whatever my God ordains is right. And I'm going to swear, says Job, that I'm in the right in this case by the very God who has brought all of this upon me. Because there's just no one else. There's no one who can do anything else. There's no one who can fix the situation. There's no one who can change or modify it or vindicate it. God will make right every wrong that He has, in fact, permitted. And Job is saying, He is the only one who can. He is the only one who can. Well, this is very high theology, but it is the high theology that is behind the cross, isn't it? Because what was God doing on the cross? Or in the cross? What was God doing in the cross? In the person of His Son, it was God righting our wrong that we had committed against Him. See, what Job is doing, he's appealing to God against God here. He's appealing to God against God. And in the cross, God gave in Christ His life to satisfy God. God made Him to be sin who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. God set forth Jesus publicly as a propitiation through faith in His blood, so that He could be just and the justifier of all who trust in Him. It's God who breaks every fetter and rights every wrong and is in charge of every aspect of life. And it was God who was being glorified on the cross by the God-man suffering on the cross in order to satisfy God. God, through God the Father, through God the Son, was protecting us from the wrath of God. So, this is kind of a foretaste of that, as Job says, I'm going to call on God and appeal to Him, and I don't fear doing that. My heart does not approach me for any of my days. And from this point on, in the chapter, Job acts as the plaintiff in the court of law. He has wanted to appear before God. Now he speaks in the language, the judicial language of appearing before God, and he's now the plaintiff in the case. He's no longer the defendant. He decides to open a case. Who's the defendant? Well, look at verse 7. Let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. We have three defendants. We have his counselors. So Job is making his case before God, and he is the accuser now. He's the plaintiff. And so he says, He says, let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. You see, the tables are turned now. Job says, I will apply to you what you are applying to me. And then he begins to speak very similar words to what they've been speaking to him. They've been telling him over and over, chapter after chapter, about the punishment of God on the wicked, on the unrighteous, and their descendants, and their property, and all that's going to befall them. And Job is saying, I agree with you, and it's you. It's you. You are the men. Let you be as the unrighteous. And then he throws in language that's very much like they've used. For what is the hope of the godless when God cuts him off, when God takes away his life? Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? So he's using their arguments and saying, you are the man. You have said this kind of thing to me. I am the plaintiff against you now. And then he says, I will teach you concerning the hand of God. That's an interesting statement. because Job is uniquely qualified to teach concerning the hand of God. Back in chapter 19, verse 21, he appealed to them. He said, "Have mercy on me, have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. The hand of God has touched me." And so he's saying, all right, you want to know about power? You want to know about God touching and afflicting and exercising his power against somebody? I'm an expert. I'm an expert. You can see my suffering. You can hear the croak of my voice. You can see my ravaged skin. And I will teach you concerning the hand of God. Sometimes in the book of Job, the hand of God doesn't mean so much power as it means something else. What would you guess it would mean besides power? Well, let's ask you, does the phrase sound safe or dangerous? Yeah. It can be judgment of God. It can be the judgment of God. There's one passage where Job is talking against his comforter's mechanistic ideas about the wicked back in Job 12, verses 9 and 10. He is saying in this argument, it's so obvious that the wicked prosper, and it's so obvious that some of them do just fine until they've lost their last breath. It's clear that they don't suffer always. And he asks this rhetorical question, who among all these, and he's referring there to beasts and birds and bushes and fish, and he says, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. He's saying not only does the man on the street know this, the beasts on the street know it, and the fishes in the sea know it. The hand of God holds every life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. So here, the hand means God's sovereign control. It means God's sovereign control and God's providence. In our passage, it means, as Matthew said, judgment or his power. In other words, his hand can bless, his hand can hold, his hand can crush. The hand of God can do all those things. Job says, what is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Job has been learning things about God that these counselors do not know. He has profound insights because of his suffering and his experience. You ever know anybody like that? There was an interesting turning point in my life when I was a chaplain during my seminary years at a nursing home. I had to have a ministry every summer, so I spent one summer being the chaplain at a very large Baptist nursing home. And I visited the patients and read the Bible to them and prayed with them. And one day, there was wheeled into the nursing home a new patient. And she was a very, very beautiful woman. She was 45 years old. Not the sort of woman that you usually see in a nursing home. But she was, as I say, quite beautiful. And she had multiple sclerosis. And so, since she was of no further use to her husband, he divorced her and put her in a nursing home. So there she was, at a midpoint through her life, stricken with this disease so that she could not walk. And she had been committed to this nursing home so that, and her husband was filing for divorce. One day I went into Martha's room to talk to her, and I asked her if she would like to pray. And so I prayed first, and then she prayed, and she began her prayer, this woman who had been cast off and was now suffering so greatly in the prime of life. She began her prayer by saying, Sovereign God. I never had heard anybody begin a prayer saying, Sovereign God, before. It just incredibly moved me, and especially coming from one who was suffering so much, inside and out. Well, she had something to teach me about the Almighty. And Job has something to teach his counselors here. Those who suffer, of course, are ordained to suffer, but their sufferings are not in vain. Romans 8 teaches that. The whole book of 1 Peter teaches that. And Job is saying here, I know about the Almighty. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Verse 12, Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? Job has simply said, Let my enemy be as the unrighteous. Now he says, You've seen the hand of God yourselves. As a matter of fact, that's all you talk about. That's all you talk about. How God's hand goes forth striking people. And he says, Do you really think that you will escape it? That's what the phrase means. Why then have you become altogether vain? You're going to face your own medicine. You're going to be subject to it too. And the reason you're going to be subject to it is because you are as unrighteous. And why are you as unrighteous? Because of your attitude toward me. That's what he's saying. He's saying, Let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. And you'll get what you have been diagnosing for me. So in verse 13, he expounds to his counselors a truth that we studied way back when we were looking together at the seventh psalm. You remember that part in the seventh psalm where it says in verse 14, Behold, the wicked man conceives evil and is pregnant with mischief and gives birth to lies. He makes a pit, digging it out, and falls into the hole that he has made. His mischief returns upon his own head, and on his own skull his violence descends. Well, that's what Job is speaking about now. He turns their theology on them. Now, understand that Job has always believed the same way they did, just more in belief. He knows that, yes, sometimes the wicked do suffer in this life, but they don't always. And that's where he's different. He also knows that the righteous don't always escape suffering in this life. They're not always externally blessed. And the righteous sometimes do very much suffer in this life. And he can only guess what the purposes might be, but he has trust in God, even though it all seems so very unfair. So in these verses, he says, very much like they would say, this is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his descendants have not enough bread. Those who survive him, the pestilence buries, and his widows do not weep. Though he heap up silver like dust, and pile up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. You know, that's true sometimes. That's true sometimes. The French Bible Society, they're the equivalent in France of the American Bible Society, is headquartered in Paris in the House of Voltaire. Isn't that a comforting thought about the sovereignty of God? You just never know who's going to wind up with your silver or your clothing like clay. He may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it and the innocent will divide the silver. He builds his house like a moth's, like a booth that a watchman makes. What's a booth in the Bible? It's not what you sidle into after church to order a burger and a shake. Yeah, it's a temporary shelter. It's a temporary shelter made out of tree limbs, tree boughs, palm fronds, whatever. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, the Israelites deliberately made booths. They camped out, and they made those booths to remind them of their wilderness wanderings. But there were also booths that armies made when they were camped in the field. There were booths that were made as shelters for animals, but they were never a strong dwelling that could survive all kinds of weather. And so what he's saying here is he builds his house like a moth, like a booth that a watchman makes. It doesn't matter if it's William Randolph Hearst's San Simeon house in California, it's still no more secure than a booth that a watchman makes apart from God. He goes to bed rich but will do so no more. He opens his eyes and his wealth is gone. Read an interesting quote recently from Nellie Connolly. Nellie Connolly is, of course, the last survivor from the automobile in which President Kennedy was riding when he was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. And she is one of the biggest problems for the Warren Commission, because she has always maintained there were three shots. And the magic bullet didn't go through JFK and John, her husband. Nellie Connolly is still living, and there was a very interesting and poignant quote from her. She says, "John and I got everything we ever wanted. We just lost it all." Because those of you who know something about the Connolly history know that he was an extremely powerful man, Secretary of the Treasury at one time, and went bankrupt and sold virtually all of his belongings, lost his incredible fortune. And this is the kind of thing that's mentioned in verse 19. He goes to bed rich, but will do so no more. He opens his eyes, and his wealth is gone. Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. The east wind lifts him up, and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place, like it's describing a tornado or a cyclone. It hurls at him without pity. He flees from its power in headlong flight. And then Job ends with the most terrifying part of the retribution. And if you have a New King James Version or a New American Standard Version, you almost have the right translation. If you have an ESV or an NIV, forget it. Listen carefully. Because these third-person pronouns are not neuter. It's not an it that claps its hands. It's not an it that hisses at him, and it's not an it that has a place. So the New King James and the New American Standard have recognized this, and they've tried to do something about it. They've translated something along the lines of men clap their hands at him and hiss at him out of his place, or like they hiss the rich man out of his place. They banish him by hissing. That, according to Elmer Smick, who is one of the greatest of all commentators on Job, says it just isn't what the Hebrew says. But the Hebrew says is he claps his hands at him and hisses at him from his place. That place is heaven, and the him is God. That is the worst part of this judgment. He claps his hands at him in derision and hisses at him from his place. Does that remind you of a psalm? Look at Psalm 2. Look at Psalm 2. About the nations raging and the peoples plotting in vain and the kings of earth setting themselves and the rulers taking counsel against the Lord and against His anointed. Look at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then He will speak to them in His wrath and terrify them in His fury, saying, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." He speaks there about the heritage that He will give to His Son, the nations of the earth, the ends of the earth. And ends the psalm by saying in verse 12, "Kiss the Son, lest He be angry and you perish in the way, for His wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him." What Job is saying here is, I'll tell you about God. He will bring all of these kinds of so-called natural disasters and tragic consequences on the wicked, and you'll be part of it because of the way you've treated me. And then he says, finally, the worst punishment of all is that he claps his hand at him. In other words, it's the hand of God from verse 11. I'll teach you concerning the hand of God. How does it all end? He claps his hands at him in mocking and derision, and hisses at him from his place. A terrifying note of judgment as Job becomes the plaintiff and takes on his counselors as defendants and appeals his case to the judge of all the earth. And a terrifying thing to remember for us. The important thing for us, of course, is to keep close to the Lord and keep putting our faith in God, even though we feel like God has brought us through many difficult situations or has made us undergo many trials and much suffering. It is that God who has taken away our right and who has made our soul bitter that we need to trust in the most, because only He is in sovereign control, and only He has shown how much He loves us in sending His Son to die for us. Well, next week we'll do chapter 28, my very favorite chapter in the book of Job.